If Bitcoin didn't exist, I have no idea where I would store my wealth, right? Because real estate, buy side and sell side are getting hammered. Everyone's terrified. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Fixed income, why would you want to lock in 5% over 10, 20 years when inflation was just at, keep in mind, CPI inflation, so low bar estimate, was at 9, 10% last year, and it's probably going to be higher going over the next decade. Stocks, if we're in a high inflationary environment, there's no telling, you know, what companies will be able to survive and come out of that. You've got AI as sort of this other dark horse. So like, is that going to tear up some business models? So for all of those reasons, Bitcoin is the flight to quality, right? It is the asset that you need right now when everything else is uncertain. 21 million Bitcoin is certain. Sovereign is much more than a premium energy drink. Crafted with precision and purpose, Sovereign is the perfect blend of physical vitality and financial sovereignty. Infused with premium ingredients like L-tyrosine, L-theanine, vitamin C, vitamin B complex, as well as alpha GPS to orchestrate a symphony of energy, heightened cognitive prowess, and calming clarity. And that's not even the best part. With each sip, you're not just recharging yourself, but you're also accumulating Bitcoin. Each can has a hidden QR code that with just three clicks brings you Bitcoin, a minimum of 500 Satoshis and up to 1 million Satoshis with each can. Sip your way to sovereignty with Sovereign Energy. Head to svrnenergy.com and use the code BLOCKWARE for 10% off. This video is sponsored by Stampseed. You plan on holding your Bitcoin for decades, so you need to make sure that your seed phrase is documented in something that can last just as long. Stampseed's signature titanium plates and stamping kits do just that. If you simply write your Bitcoin seed phrase down on a piece of paper, it's vulnerable to fire, water, and all sorts of erosion that can happen over time. Make sure you keep it secure for years to come. Head to stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the BLOCKWARE podcast. This week, I'm excited to bring on BLOCKWARE's own Chief Revenue Officer, Danny Condon. I think this may be your second, third, fourth appearance on the BLOCKWARE podcast. I honestly have no idea. So thanks for joining us, Danny.
Yeah, Mitch, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to start piggybacking on a conversation I had on Spaces this week surrounding the spot ETF. So there's conflicting opinions out there because when you, of course, own Bitcoin in the ETF, you don't actually own Bitcoin, right? Not your keys, not your coins. 1000% agree with that. So Danny, how are you thinking about the ETF? Are you concerned about people not holding their own keys? What's your overall take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can take it from a couple different lenses. I'm definitely a, you know, personal believer of not your coins or not your keys, not your coin. But I think I'm also like a pretty, I think I'm a pretty practical dude. And I think that the most important, you know, one of the most important factors as we look forward is just adoption, right? I think that Bitcoin is just a massive, it's the most disruptive technology the world has ever seen in the most important industry being, you know, broadly, you know, money that is a common denominator between everybody in the world. And it's really all just about adoption. It's no different than looking at cell phone adoption curve or any other disruptive, you know, technology adoption curve. So I think that yes, while there are, you know, theoretical or literal trade-offs from a security perspective or custodial perspective, that the ETFs are actually going to, you know, shepherd in a significant incremental wave of adoption. And I almost look at them as solutions in some sense relative to people's, you know, appetite to take on custodial, personal custodial responsibility. I see it as a solution to the, you know, fear and uncertainty that many, you know, future adopters currently have when it comes to, you know, custody, right? I'll unpack that a little bit because that was kind of a word salad, but I'll throw that back at you. You know, what are your thoughts there just in general? And we can go a little deeper maybe on that point.
Yeah, I think generally it's a great thing that we're getting this because the world is not ready for self-custody right now. And I don't think the entire world will be ready a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. But if we're looking forward, you know, 5, 10, 20 years, yeah, there's going to be a lot more self-custody products that are more user-friendly. They're getting built out, right? But this kind of stuff doesn't happen overnight. So I think the ETF is a really great short-term solution. And as this capital gets put into Bitcoin, the value of the asset will go up. Bitcoin could become a $5, $10, $20 trillion asset. And then the incentive there, it's stronger financial incentive for people to build these collaborative custody solutions. So it's like, exactly. It's the perfect intermediate.
Exactly. I mean, it's like actually a core piece of, you know, Bitcoin ethos is like economic incentives to take action, right? It's like, look at the spectrum of custodial risk as well as, you know, security, right? As you, if you look at, you know, cold storage solutions, single sig, you know, fully controlled wallets, you have, you know, theoretically, these are going to be broad strokes, but you have maximum security, but you are the risk, right? So like a lot of folks, and again, we're talking about the now world. I agree that the future will be a lot different on the back of incremental adoption and incremental, you know, price appreciation, right? You go to the other end of the spectrum and it's like FTX, right? I mean, rehypothecation of customer funds, like paper Bitcoin that is actually being, you know, I mean, that, and that's just a fucking scam, pardon my French,
yeah.
Right? That's the other end of the spectrum. And then in the middle, you have things like, I'm looking at, again, I'm making a leap here, but, you know, ETFs as effectively a custody solution, right? There are a lot of high net worth individuals out there that would like to have exposure to Bitcoin that only trust their, you know, Fidelity financial advisor, their Morgan Stanley, their, you know, BlackRock, their so on and so forth. So there's a lot of dry powder out there that will adopt when they can just go to their dude, you know, and say, hey, get me in that ETF, right? Guess what happens then? That fund, who is clearly going to be significantly regulated because it's going through all of these proper channels, they have to go hold that Bitcoin into one-to-one. So I see this as actually like very positive regulatory, you know, advancement here that leads to safer, relatively speaking, safer custodial solutions that will increase adoption significantly, which makes price go up, which creates an incentive for innovation within the ecosystem, inclusive of self-custody, you know, solutions, which will play a larger part in the future world, you know, when we get to that future world.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the idea that BlackRock would pull off like a mass rehypothecation the same way FTX did, it just doesn't make sense. For one, they own a ton of these mining stocks. They own MicroStrategy. They want the price of Bitcoin to go up, and they'll make bigger fees on the ETF when the price goes up. So all the incentives work for them to not do that. And then another point you made that I really agree with is these capital allocators, they're going to be comfortable with their existing platforms, right? They don't want to go even to a Coinbase. They sure as heck don't want to go to a Binance to buy Bitcoin. And I think the really important point is that it gives the Wall Street stamp of approval, right? Most people aren't forward thinking, they're not risk seeking, and they view Bitcoin as a risk asset. So when Larry Fink calls it a flight to quality, and then that's going to trickle down through all of Wall Street, the sentiment is shifting. They're going to have that stamp of approval effectively, and they're going to no longer think of Bitcoin as a risk asset. It's going to be more viewed as something that should be a part of a conventional portfolio. Whether that's 1%, 0.5%, 10% is yet to be seen, but it doesn't take a lot to move the needle because there's hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of capital out there, and Bitcoin still has a market cap less than 1 trillion.
Exactly. And, you know, you get to Bitcoin got to $1 trillion market cap with effectively zero institutional participation. So wait till deep park pockets.
Yeah.
Party, right?
It got there with basically only one Michael Saylor and then FTX selling paper Bitcoin to try to keep the price down. So imagine you've got 10, 20 Michael Saylors out there and no FTX. This thing could really blow the roof off.
There's a lot of billionaires out there, right, Mitch? There's a lot of I think Michael Saylor is a god and an innovator and a champion, you know, and a lot of, you know, and a genius and so on and so forth. But like Larry Fink's got a larger reach than him, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's just a fact. And there are a lot of folks like Jamie Dimon, who eventually is going to pivot once he, you know, it's opportunistic for him. He's got a long reach, right? The future president of the United States or president of XYZ country has got a bigger reach than all those people. We will be in a world where these are, you know, active participants. And then the, you know, whole, you know, script will be flipped to it's like, what is Bitcoin to like, Bitcoin is just an everyday part of my life. Right, 99% of people don't think about money or economics or Bitcoin or dollars or inflation or whatever. They're just like, I need money to go do things, to go buy groceries, to, you know, go to a movie, to play golf, whatever. Right? It's like Bitcoin will be that, you know, unit of transaction at some point too, which is, I don't know. I mean, I just think it's fascinating and it's coming.
Yeah, 100%. I'm looking forward to that when I can just literally spend my Bitcoin anywhere. On your point about Michael Saylor, before we move on to a different topic, I saw, so one of my favorite followers following on Twitter is Wicked Smart Bitcoin. He put out a tweet yesterday. I'll have to go back and double check the math, but MicroStrategy has like 140,000 Bitcoin. That's the same amount that's going to get mined during the entire next halving epoch. So he's one, right? The rest of the Wall Street billionaires, they can come in and they could put in a large dollar amount, but they're not going to be able to catch up to his stack size in terms of Bitcoin. That ship has sailed. They haven't realized it yet. So Michael Saylor is absolutely going to be the wealthiest man in the world in the next 10 years. And there's no doubt in my mind about that.
Yeah, man. I mean, you hit on an interesting topic, which is probably a good segue too, is just like looking at, you know, liquidity or illiquidity, you know, from a supply perspective, you know, and then we're also talking, you know, organically about different demand vectors, and we even got to the halving, right? So it's like, that's a really great illustration of this is, you know, the amount of Bitcoin that is going to be released every, you know, approximately 10 minutes, you know, for the next approximately 4 years, starting in approximately, what, 5-6 months, is getting cut in half. That's going to happen. That's called supply shock. What happens when you remove half of the incremental supply of something? The demand stays constant, right? Now, what happens if you pour significant demand gasoline on top of that? You have, you know, drastically disproportionate, you know, demand to the amount of now decreasing incremental supply. That means number go up. That's just basic economics.
Dude, you're getting me so bullish right now because the demand is not going to relinquish, right? Just looking at the smallest users on chain with less than one Bitcoin, they're buying up all 900 Bitcoin that get mined every single day and then some. And then that 900 Bitcoin in 6 months is going to be 450 Bitcoin per day. They're not going to stop buying, right? Because these guys, they didn't stop buying when FTX collapsed. They bought more. They didn't stop buying when the banking crisis happened and there was fear in the market. They bought more. They started buying more again this week on the rally, right? So this demand is not going anywhere. And there's going to be a supply shock. You're going to see about mining. You're going to see those weakest miners. They're going to have to, they're the ones selling the most Bitcoin right now too. So you've got, you know, a lot of the network at 6, 7, 8 cents running S19s, they're having to sell a decent amount to cover their operating expense. Not as much this week after the pump, but, you know, as we get to that halving, those weaker miners are going to unplug. The existing miners, they're going to have more room to breathe, be selling less Bitcoin. Meanwhile, the dark horse, of course, is the demand from the ETF. So everything really, really is coming together. And this is just all the Bitcoin native stuff, not even to mention, you know, if the macro situation deteriorates and we resort to QE, which that's a topic for another podcast. So all the things really seem to be working together towards Bitcoin right now. And my best guess is we have maybe 3, 4, 5 months left of like relatively cheap Bitcoin. But in 2024, this thing is going to absolutely melt faces.
Yeah, man. Okay. So let's unpack that a little bit, like from a demand catalyst and a supply catalyst perspective. Cause I think, you know, a lot of the listeners are all across the spectrum. And I think one thing that we do as passionate Bitcoiners is forget that like we are the drastic minority in the world right now. And that's, you know, most people in the world don't know or care anything about, you know, economic theory or economics in general. And then of the folks that do, you know, a small percentage of them care or know about Bitcoin. Now this is all going to change, right? But people can grasp like basic, you know, supply and demand economics. So let's look at some of the, first let's start with the demand side, okay? So what are some catalysts? You just nailed a few of these, but ETF, right? And now practically speaking, not to belabor everything we discussed, but an ETF is going to make it significantly easier for high likely to adopt, reasonably deep pocketed adopters to adopt with ease, right? And what's going to happen, you know, paraphrasing all this or just kind of moving faster, is like BlackRock is going to offer this to their customers, and you know, an ETF, I think it's IBTC, right? Another iShares ETF, just like any one of the, you know, probably hundreds or thousands of other products that they offer in their portfolio. And then they're going to go and physically purchase, again, for lack of a better term, they're going to go and purchase an equal amount of Bitcoin, and it's going to be held, you know, in cold storage, which I believe Coinbase is their custodian for this, right? So what's worked through that chain? These folks are going to, you know, as part of this, you're now getting significant incremental adoption, not of these individuals, and think these are like, you know, successful business people that are, I'm typecasting here again, but that are, you know, 50 to 67 years old, that have had good careers, that are used to investing, right? They've got 401ks, which, by the way, you can go buy these ETFs in your 401k. You can go buy GBTC in your 401k right now. There are solutions like Swan and Unchained that provide, you know, Bitcoin native cold storage IRA solutions right now. This is not, you know, but those are a little bit more like niche native from an understanding perspective, right? But what's going to happen is basically like, you're going to get significant adoption of people that want exposure to Bitcoin. They're going to buy these ETFs. The ETF, you know, product provider is going to go and buy this Bitcoin. That creates a drastic demand, you know, increase for the purchase of Bitcoin, right? I'm kind of standing away from the supply side for a second, but just think like everything is supply and demand. So you've got that as a demand-based catalyst, right? I mean, I think that's one that's, you know, significantly massive. What's another one that...
Yeah, I'll throw one at you. I actually think, obviously, the halving's a supply catalyst, but I think there's a demand aspect to it as well. Simply looking on-chain, there's massive spikes in demand on-chain activity in the months after the halving. Now, you could say that's because the prices started going up, so you just see that naturally as it's sort of a bull market. But we're getting to the point where you're seeing mainstream media outlets start talking about the halving, right? I wasn't around in 2020, but I don't think it was like a common piece of conversation outside of the Bitcoin circles. It's still not ultra common, but at least on like a Fox Business or a CNBC Business, they're starting to mention it, and it's still 6 months away. So I imagine when this happens, they're gonna really start hammering down, like every segment, every day is they're gonna mention Bitcoin halving, Bitcoin halving. And on top of that, this is going to be the sales weapon for the ETF, right? Because they can point at this and say, look, every time this thing has happened with Bitcoin, the price has ripped in the 6 to 12 months that follow. Therefore, you should probably get some exposure. And wouldn't you know, we have this handy dandy vehicle where you can get Bitcoin in a way that you're already familiar with.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I can speak from firsthand experience and, you know, years of doing this. Salespeople like selling products that are, you know, they like selling the best products that can largely sell themselves. The best products that can largely sell themselves have, you know, very strong evidence, you know, kind of seller's proof, if you will, of the validity of the product that they're selling. Salespeople are motivated because they get paid, you know, more when they sell more of whatever it is that they're selling. There are tens of thousands of salespeople who will be armed across, name the institution, that are going to be personally incentivized to go sell the product that is most easily sellable, right? Number go up. That's an adoption thing. I'm going to also piggyback real quick on like the halving as a catalyst. It's so hard to stay away from just jumping into why it's a significant supply catalyst, but we're going to get into that too. But running with the, you know, on the demand side, what that's doing is it's educating the masses of the, you know, programmatically coded, you know, incrementally deflationary, you know, supply schedule, right? Mm-hmm. And you see Larry Fink on CNBC, like all the buzz right now is flight to safety, right? Like who would have thought that, I mean, we would have, but that the theme right now is like flight to safety. So it's actually, I think, a demand catalyst is how unsexy a lot of other investment opportunities are in light of staying a little bit away from the macro, but think like, you know, look at like the housing market, for example. The Fed has destroyed the housing market. Interest rates are 8%+ right now, right?
Like yeah.
That industry is destroyed. If you wanted to go refinance, if you have a 4% mortgage, right? And you're going to go and you got a, you know, $1 million property, like you're going to pay, and yeah, you got to, or you're buying something, it's 8%, right? So yeah. Like money moves to places where, you know, even look at like yield, look at bonds, right? Thought of as historically like risk-free saving vehicles. I'm not buying a 10-year bond at the yield that it's at, you know, right now. If no. I were, you know, interested in buying fixed income, you know, assets in general, it's like, so it's actually, I mean, look at like, you know, the NASDAQ, look at some of these growth vehicles, right? Go look at, you know, the S&P, like there aren't a ton of really good other options right now too. So the lack of other investable, you know, asset classes, I think actually creates an incremental demand vector for Bitcoin under this, you know, mantra of flight to safety. So in some ways, like the fact that, you know, because the halving has this, you know, programmatically coded, you know, incrementally deflationary monetary policy, the halving is also a demand catalyst because it becomes the most in-demand product.
Very well said. Yeah, the halving, definitely an educational moment too, because I remember a couple months ago when Jamie Dimon went on and he's like, how do we know Bitcoin's actually scarce? What if Satoshi pops up at the end, blah, blah, blah. So when the halving happens, people are like, oh, this is how that works. And then you hit on another great point about other assets. If Bitcoin didn't exist, I have no idea where I would store my wealth, right? Because real estate, buy side and sell side are getting hammered. Everyone's terrified. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Fixed income, why would you want to lock in 5% over 10, 20 years when inflation was just at, keep in mind, CPI inflation, so low bar estimate, was at 9, 10% last year, and it's probably going to be higher going over the next decade. Stocks, if we're in a high inflationary environment, there's no telling, you know, what companies will be able to survive and come out of that. You've got AI as sort of this other dark horse, so like, is that going to tear up some business models? So where are you going to go, right? You need something that can't be messed with. So that rules out any fiat instrument. You need something that's, you know, sort of limited in supply, which sort of just leaves you with real estate, which we already talked about is messed up. And then you're left with gold and Bitcoin. But like gold hasn't really done anything over the last decade. There's a lot of manipulation in that market. Not that, I guess the argument there would be that happens with Bitcoin too, but gold is a dead rock. Like Bitcoin is just so much superior to gold in every imaginable way. You can actually take self-custody of large amounts, right? If you have $1 billion worth of gold, you have to put that in a bank vault and trust other people. If geopolitical tensions rise, if you know your government turns hostile, you're not getting that gold. Bitcoin is divisible. You can actually build a monetary and like economic system around it. Gold, they couldn't do that in the technological age. That's why fiat came around. For all of those reasons, Bitcoin is the flight to quality, right? It is the asset that you need right now when everything else is uncertain. 21 million Bitcoin is certain.
Dude, spot on, man. Spot on. So let's look at the supply side a little bit, right? Because the thesis here is supply and demand-based economics. So let's talk about the impact of the halving on supply and like practically what that means, right? Because I think people are starting to wake up to the fact that like, okay, the amount of incremental money that will be released on the programmatically scheduled, you know, schedule is going to be cut in half. Like, all right, face value, dope. Now, what does that actually mean from a practicality perspective? So all incremental Bitcoin that is released every 10 minutes is released to those that are mining Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin mining is incentive-based. You're you know, effectively arbitraging energy. I think we'll probably end up getting into mining, you know, a decent bit on this pod, on this episode as well. So won't go into all the intricacies, but Bitcoin miners are incentivized, you know, to deploy capital and carry operating expenses because they have the opportunity to arbitrage energy using Bitcoin as that energy, that arbitrage vehicle, right? Now, because they have a cost associated with, and this is like, in my opinion, the most beautiful thing about, you know, the whole, just the Bitcoin network, is they have a cost associated with this. This is proof of work at its finest. Mm-hmm. It is immensely logical to assume that they are going to be the largest sell pressure on the network on any given time, especially in these relatively early epochs, because, you know, they're the ones getting all the incremental supply. So the most amount of incremental Bitcoin is flowing to Bitcoin miners. And then they have to cover, you know, operating expenses and so on and so forth, right? So a very, like, I would say, reasonable, logical, especially in a world where you have high interest rates and there's not an incentive necessarily economically for miners to hodl, you know, to like take on debt, for example, to go to hodl more their Bitcoin and play a lucrative treasury strategy. Bitcoin miners are selling, like, you know, at a minimum in general to cover their operating expenses. I think that that's probably, you know, over the entire mining landscape at a minimum the norm, if not selling, you know, dollarizing immediately. And I saw a really interesting session. It was actually at the Pacific Bitcoin, which I did not attend, unfortunately, but I watched the live stream. It was the treasury management strategy. And I think it was CFO for, I think it was TerraWolf maybe. It just mentioned, like, the HODL strategy is dead. You don't pay, you know, Shell or, you know, so on and so forth, you know, oil extraction. Like, they don't, you don't want them as a shareholder to be like holding barrels of oil because the oil will increase. Their job is to arbitrage it. We can mine it. You know, we can create it cheaper than anybody. Then we sell it. We lock in that arbitrage margin. We're returning value to the shareholders. I'm making a drastic point. I think there's a lot of gray in there. And I personally think that a treasury strategy on top of this is probably the winning strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, more on the lines of like Marathon would be on the other end of that spectrum, where once upon a time, Core Scientific was on the far end of that spectrum. And unfortunately, the market turned drastically against it. And that made that bet not pay off, right? And mm-hmm. they went bankrupt. And now they're, you know, emerging from there, which I think that they're actually in a pretty good forward-looking position. So long story short, the biggest sell pressure, you know, on the network by far are miners, because they are the most logically incentivized sellers. Now, when the halving hits, in a binary outcome capacity, the amount of potential Bitcoin that they could sell is cut in half. Mm-hmm. There's no other like economic binary outcome, you know, supply schedule where it's like, it just gets cut in half, right? And in addition to that, you know, you get. I mean, I won't elaborate too much further on that because I think I've talked too much on this specific point. But the outcome here is what that means is significant supply shock, because there are 50% less motivated sellers, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is now coinciding with unprecedented demand. The halving in and of itself take away this like kind of, you know, again, unprecedented demand side with the ETFs, you know, looming and adoption, you know, increasing and the snowball effect on the, you know, precipice of manifesting. Like the halving in and of itself is a significantly bullish catalyst for price appreciation. Now you put into this the demand that's contextually relevant to what we're going to see over the next, you know, 2 years, it's going to be an explosion. This is just basic economic theory. It's not rocket science, right? We could be talking about this. Take Bitcoin out of the equation. If we're talking about these being the principles of any other, you know, economically supply and demand based, you know, scenario, it's the same thing. It's like, holy shit, this thing's about to rocket.
Yeah.
Really long
speech. Definitely. that was great. And there's a lot we could dive into there. The one thing that kind of stuck out to me is this treasury HODL strategy. it's interesting because Bitcoin is a commodity, but it's also a scarcity. And other commodities, right? If you're drilling oil, you're not going to hodl your oil, right? Because the way these commodity markets work is the price basically trends towards the cost of production. If there's a massive discrepancy between what's the market price of the asset or the commodity, and then how much does it cost to produce, that gap's going to get closed, right? Because if you can drill a barrel of oil and it costs you $50 and you could sell it for $100, more people are going to start drilling for oil. It's simple economics. But when that happens, more oil is going to get discovered and the price is going to go down. And so they'll meet market price and then cost to produce. But with Bitcoin, if the price goes up, when the price goes up, sure, yeah, more people are going to want to mine Bitcoin. But that doesn't mean that new Bitcoin gets mined, right? It's still going to be, right now, it's 900 a day. 6 months from now, it's going to drop to 450 a day. No matter how much computational power in the world is dedicated towards Bitcoin mining, they cannot produce more than what is allowed by the network. So it makes it vastly different from all the other commodities, which sort of changes the incentive. All right, if you're the miner, do you want to hold this or do you want to sell it? Right now, like you mentioned, a lot of them are selling because, well, for one, margins have been pretty thin throughout the last year or so. Again, the price going up has relieved some of that stress. And two, there's not a lot of access to debt or equity financing at this moment because we've been going through a bear market. Should the tide shift to a bull market, that could change and they may start hodling more, selling less because they have access to other means to pay for their operating expense. But as it stands, they're having to sell a lot. And when the halving happens, it might not be immediate relief, right? You might see some of them burn through whatever Bitcoin treasury they have and continue operating at a loss for a little while. But that's unsustainable. They can't do that forever. So you're going to see the weakest miners have to capitulate, which is going to lower difficulty, which means the surviving miners will have to sell even less Bitcoin, and then supply and demand right there.
Yeah, I mean, spot on, man. And I think the bow around the whole package here is just like, you know, demand is, we have significant, you know, demonstrable objective demand catalysts in the near-term horizon. And we also have significant supply reduction near-term catalysts, you know, as well, right? Mm-hmm. You get incremental demand and incremental supply. That means that, you know, buyers of Bitcoin are going to be motivated, you know, incentivized to, well, you know, you're going to pay more for Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. Because one thing that we haven't hit on too is that 70% of the supply hasn't moved in a year. It's people like you and me who have just been buying endlessly and we don't want to sell. We don't have to sell either, right? So it's going to be an incredible period of price discovery. Like, at what point are hodlers sort of incentivized enough to take some chips off the table? They won't take them all off, but they may start distributing at certain price points.
And that's where I think, like, you know, again, trying to take a very real and practical view of this, like, a large reason that, you know, supply has not moved is because it's been, you know, just down market and people have been stacking and so on and so forth. And we're at 100, 200, 300,000 Bitcoin. You will, I do think, see people taking chips off the table. That's natural, but these are like champagne problems at that time. The other thing it's not accounted for is like the snowball compounding kind of FOMO effect of, you know, significant price appreciation. I mean, we just went from, what, 26 to 34, 35K Bitcoin, like, pretty damn quickly, and people are losing it, right? It's like, oh my God, we are so backed. This is amazing. Wait till you've got, you know, normie adoption through ETFs that move this thing from, you know, 60 to 100,000 in like a 2 week period, right? I'm being, you know, a bit facetious, but it's very possible. Because remember, the ETF passing is not like, okay, cool, we're going to get like a bazillion God candle. I do think we will, and you're going to see funds start to seed, which is probably what's happening right now. But the real add-on effect happens over time as adopters start actually buying these ETF products, and then the ETFs have to purchase more Bitcoin from a, you know, increasingly supply or scarce supply. And then, you know, the price of these ETFs go up, and those who are owning these ETFs are like, this is epic. And you start to get other people who are like, man, they're playing golf. They're at their country club. It's like, yeah, I got in on that Bitcoin ETF, man. I'm making a loot right now. Guy pulls out his phone and slam buys on his Fidelity app, which is where he can do that anyways. That's what happens. And that's where we really start to get this price appreciation. So ETFs passing are basically like the opening of the gates. But then ETFs being around and starting to be successful and increasing in, you know, value in extremely liquid channels, that's where like the party really starts.
Yeah, I agree. The ETF passing, that's the starting line. Things will get interesting in the months and years after that.
Yep.
So let's imagine this. We get this God candle, which I think we can agree is most likely coming. But it's still going to cost, you know, the same amount in dollar terms to mine Bitcoin, right? So then that presents a very interesting opportunity because, yeah, price can go up 2-3x in very short order, but hash rate cannot do the same. So there's going to be an opportunity for Bitcoin miners. Let's dive into that. What are your overall thoughts?
Yeah, okay. I think that, like, as, you know, it's hard for people to really, especially those who are, you know, familiar with Bitcoin mining, and I think Bitcoin mining is one of the overly... it's almost like scary conceptually, but it's actually insanely simple, right? I think so. One, it's going to become a lot more, you know, mainstream, but I think like from an opportunistic perspective, incumbent miners coming out of bear markets into bull markets, which turn very quickly, have historically and will, in my opinion, at least for the next few epochs, be the ones who are positioned to win at the greatest, you know, disproportionate level of winning, right? And so why? Well, number one, what Bitcoin mining is effectively arbitraging energy. You're taking an energy, you know, that has a reasonably fixed cost, and then you are producing Bitcoin that has a, you know, variable cost or value, right? That is based on natural, you know, economic incentives, going to have a higher, you know, weighted value than the energy that was put in. So you're arbitraging Bitcoin, you're arbitraging energy, and you're turning it into Bitcoin, right? Now, why are miners that are incumbently positioned more, you know, set up to win? You made one really good point, which is I think is super important to understanding the like practical nature of this point, which is hash rate, you know, difficulty cannot move at a pace that is anywhere near as fast as the pace at which Bitcoin can move, right? If we get an ETF, you know, when these ETFs pass and when people start coming in and the snowball effect happens, like you can shoot up 100% in value. Even just this year, we've shot up over 100% in value in Bitcoin price, right? Now, in order to get to that same equilibrium in, you know, theoretical computing, you know, available computing power, you have to build, it costs billions of dollars of investment to double the amount of computing power, you know, infrastructure, right? You're talking about ingesting a, you know, very significant amount of energy. That's a scarce commodity in and of itself. How long do you think it takes to build a power plant or a, you know, solar, you know, field or a bunch of windmills, right? Or whatever, or a dam or a natural gas, you know, turbine or whatever it might be. That takes time. How long do you think it takes? My neighbors are building a house. I've been watching that be built for 6 months. Now imagine like how much longer it takes to build a power plant. Right? Yeah. I'm kind of going through like the basics of this evolution. It takes a long time to build energy resources that can need to be consumed to, you know, increase difficulty to even keep up with price appreciation. And it takes a lot of money to do that as well. Then it takes a lot of time to build out the infrastructure, building data centers. It takes a lot of money to do that as well. So you have to have power, you have to have infrastructure, you have to have construction, you have to, you know, not mess stuff up. They were talking about like years and significant capital deployments that need to take place. So hash rate in this example is actually a drastic laggard to Bitcoin price, right? Because Bitcoin price can rocket up. And when that rockets up, you have an incentive to, you know, invest in power, you know, generation, infrastructure, you know, construction, so that you can mine Bitcoin and take advantage of that, you know, arbitrage opportunity. But as you mentioned, the cost is going to trend towards the cost of production. So eventually that will, you know, equilibrize a little bit. So the net is like Bitcoin price velocity outpaces Bitcoin hash rate increase velocity significantly, right? Mm-hmm. Or it can, right? I mean, who knows what actually plays out, but it's a lot easier for a bazillion people to go click buy or go open their Fidelity app and buy the Fidelity ETF than it is for somebody to go raise, you know, $50 million and then build a data center consuming, you know, 100 megawatts of power, right?
Yeah, very well said. And it's not even a theoretical situation that you're describing. We already saw this play out in the last cycle. Hash rate went on a bull market in 2022 after price rips. So price rips in 2021, everyone's like, oh, wow, I could buy Bitcoin. But wow, the mining economics look really good right now. So let me go raise money for that instead of putting into spot Bitcoin. And then you don't see that bull market in hash rate until 2022 and into 2023. So this will, yeah, what were you going to say?
No, exactly. And I think the other part, like another byproduct of this, there's multiple ingredients in this, you know, dish. One is like infrastructure, power, everything we talked about, and the lagging effect of that, you know, relative to price appreciate or price velocity, you know, potential velocity. But the other part is like, why are Bitcoin miners, you know, incumbent miners coming out of bear markets best position is because hardware is cheap, right? Bitcoin mining takes infrastructure, energy, and then ASICs, which are the, you know, servers that mine Bitcoin. And they are currently representative. The price is like ultra bear market price, right? So like, I can go buy really cheap miners right now relative to what the future looks like. The net present value of these miners is like, you know, nothing. Because if Bitcoin's at 100,000, you know, I'm going to like make directionally accurate statements here without, you know, having the mathematical, you know, to directly support this. But, you know, Bitcoin shoots up to 100,000. You can go buy, you know, latest generation machines for, you know, a few thousand dollars kind of thing, three, four, whatever thousand dollars. It's like you could mine that in a quarter, right? Mm-hmm. You can mine that in a month in some capacity. And then that machine is logically going to be worth like 4, 5, 6, 7 times more than it is.
Yeah. Right?
So it's like, that's why you're positioned because yeah, you can go buy cheap miners right now. And guess what? You're still arbitraging Bitcoin. You don't have the fattest spread ever. But talk to me when, you know, an S19J Pro costs $11,000 again. And you're like, oh, yeah. Shit, man, I should have bought that for $500, you know, back in the day, or, you know, $1,000 back in the day kind of thing.
Yeah, really well said. And as our chief revenue officer, this is your bread and butter, right? You're talking about ASIC pricing all day, every day. And I think what's really fascinating is going into the halving, of course, you want to have the most efficient machines possible. So there's this flight to upgrade to the latest and greatest machines right now on the market. That's S19 XPs, but you've got S21s coming. You've got the MicroBT, the M60, which effectively allows these mid-generation machines like the S19, they're going at an extreme discount because everybody's trying to dump them to get into the latest generation machines, which is a good play. But that presents an opportunity for those who are maybe a little bit more on the risk-seeking side of the spectrum to buy these cheap rigs, which, like you said, if Bitcoin goes to 100,000, yeah, that S19 is going to be printing money, and it's going to pay for itself in a relatively short order.
I think that's a very interesting topic, and it's certainly worth diving into. So if you think about like the continuum of price, so on the whole, relative to the, you know, current discount represented in Bitcoin mining rigs of any kind, relative to what they will be worth at Bitcoin, you know, 100, 200,000, whatever that might be in 1, 2 years, whenever that might be, everything's cheap, right? But if you think about it, like it's all about CapEx and then what your yield is. So I can go buy on the more expensive, you know, end of the spectrum. I can go buy, let's just say like S21s, which are a future machine, or let's say S19, let's say the XPs, for right now, because I could buy those on the spot market right now. Basically the most efficient spot market available machine, right? So I can go buy that for, let's just say, $4,000, right? And I'm going to make, again, directionally accurate, you know, $100 a month, $200 a month in profit on that machine, right? And I'm also going to have protection, the most protection, because I have the most efficient machine relative to, like, Bitcoin starts to dump, then I'm the least likely to capitulate because I have more efficient machines. It's going to be less efficient miners with less efficient hardware. Energy is a huge part of this equation as well, but I'm just making this a hardware example for purposes of keeping it one-dimensional, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to be safe and my, you know, arbitrage opportunity will almost certainly be intact through, like, any market conditions because my machines are more efficient than 51% of the other people, meaning that I'm going to be, you know, in the top 49% quadrant and I don't have to capitulate, right?
Yeah.
It's in the downside scenario. Now, but I'm paying more on, like, a box basis, right? These are just servers. So on a server basis, I'm paying more for that for the opportunity to have a higher yield right now and more protection in the future, right? Now let's go look at the other end of the spectrum. Look at, you know, relative legacy, kind of current, you know, generation, you know, hardware like an S19J Pro or an M30S Plus or an M30S, for example. Now I can go buy, you know, an M30S on the Blockware marketplace for like under $400. Now, right now it's making like $8 per day, right? And if Bitcoin dumps or the halving, you know, approaches, it's on the weaker end of the spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. But if Bitcoin rips and the disproportionate, you know, velocity, you know, potential of Bitcoin price relative to that of difficulty plays out, you know, we rip up to like 50,000 by the end of the year, I'm paying for that $400, $500 purchase in like 2 months.
Yeah.
Right? And then it's like, I don't care what this machine's worth anymore. I've already paid for it and I'm making $400 a month on something that cost me $400. It looks like the best investment of all time. So I like to think about that as like a kind of a low premium call option on Bitcoin, like a, you know, out of the money call option on Bitcoin. Whereas a XP, for example, is a more expensive, logically, you know, so mm-hmm. kind of, you know, well in the money call option on Bitcoin, right? Now, they're both like relative leveraged bets where I have an arbitrage opportunity on the underlying asset being Bitcoin, but I have more to gain, but more likelihood to lose if I buy a, you know, more legacy oriented machine, and I have, you know, less risk with a more efficient machine. So I personally think that, you know, kind of like anything, like a kind of a balanced portfolio of rigs is a good play. You know, you want to be like,
yeah,
60% stuff that's not going to get you into any trouble and still give you the opportunity. And maybe you want to have 10% of your portfolio or like moonshot bets, because I can go buy an M30S, for example, on the Blockware marketplace for $400 right now. And if Bitcoin, you know, keeps ripping, if we get another 25% increase, I'm so in the money that it is, you know. And by the way, my machine is going to, you know, it's a lot easier going from $400 machine to, you know, $1,200 machine or $1,800 machine is a lot easier than going from $4,000 machine to, you know, $1,000 machine, right? So the other end of the spectrum is I have asset appreciation potential.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just about being balanced across that spectrum and making sure that, you know, you're maximizing opportunity, but also you know, mitigating aggregate risk.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Going into the newest, latest generation is the safe bet, right? If you're not trying to go far on the risk curve and you don't want to bank on appreciation of the ASICs themselves, then you need to get XPs or S21s. There's a point I really want to get across to about the S21s, and like, because I think people would be concerned that, all right, when these machines are 200 terahash, it's just going to make hash rate rip to the moon. Everything else will be worth nothing. But as we've mentioned multiple times on this podcast, infrastructure is the bottleneck, right? Physical energy and places to plug the rigs in. So in order for a lot of these S21s to get online, I'm thinking you're just going to have to see S19s get unplugged and taken off the racks to make room for that. Is that something you've been thinking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like the thesis at face value of, you know, you have a bunch of 100 terahash machines right now. Now you're going to have 200 terahash machines. So it's like, okay, difficulty is going to rocket up. It's not totally invalid, but it's not acutely accurate, right? Because, and this is what we see. I mean, like what happens right now is there's a demand for incrementally efficient machines, especially when they're cheap on a futures basis right now. But people aren't like, oh, cool, I'm going to keep my legacy stuff online necessarily. I'm just selling my 8,000, you know, M30S plus pluses and buying 8,000, you know, what's minor M60s on a future basis. Mm-hmm. That's the play, right? So I do think on the balance, you know, we may see less of a difficulty decrease, you know, like in the several months following the halving than we have seen in the past because of the like almost like maturity, for lack of a better term, of the majority of the hash rate contributors right now. But I also think we are going to see a disproportionate, you know, rip on price because of the where we're at in the adoption curve, right? Like we haven't even started the hockey stick part of an adoption curve.
No.
We're like, and when that happens, you just want to have miners positioned because you're going to be able to buy, you know, $25,000 Bitcoin when Bitcoin is $100,000, right? Or you can just go to Coinbase and buy $100,000 Bitcoin, you know, or whatever, you know, Satoshi-based denomination of a Bitcoin that you'd like to purchase, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think it's a very valid point. It's not all incrementally net new super efficient hardware. It's largely hardware replacing legacy hardware.
Yeah. I think I tend to agree with that. So you've laid out, you've articulated a very nice case for why you should mine Bitcoin. All right. So I'm a Bitcoiner. I'm listening to this. What's the best way to mine Bitcoin? Where should I go to? Who should I talk to about doing that?
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously like, yeah, Blockware Solutions is the answer to that question. But let me like kind of unpack why a little bit. And I'm not trying to, you know, shill in this capacity. It's something that we've been very passionate about for the last couple of years that we brought to market is this concept of liquidity, right? So Bitcoin mining, when you're a Bitcoin mining rig is effectively a dividend paying asset, right? And people just think about the dividend side of this. So you go make a capital expenditure to buy a Bitcoin mining machine. Now let's say that costs $2,000, just throw a round number out there. That's the asset side of your investment. Now you're churning, you know, $100 per month or whatever that might be in profit at the current market. That's the dividend side of your equation. And now after 2-3 years, whatever that might be, you're going to have accumulated your entire CapEx, you know, faster if you're hodling the Bitcoin and Bitcoin is appreciating in price. And then, you know, the rest of this is gravy and you know, cause you're creating Bitcoin at a discount to the spot price of Bitcoin. It's great, right? In and of itself is a good investment thesis, but what it discounts is the opportunity cost, right, in an absence of an opportunity of capturing the appreciation on the asset side of your investment. So if Bitcoin goes from 30,000 to 60,000 or 60,000 to 120,000, you buy a $22,000 machine at, you know, $35,000 Bitcoin, it very likely and logically will be worth, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. Because it's not producing $100 a month anymore in profit. It's producing $1,000 a month in profit, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm using directionally accurate numbers. So one thing that's unique about Blockware is our marketplace that enables clients to, you know, buy and sell turnkey hashing rigs So one, if I'm looking at getting into mining Bitcoin right now, you can go to marketplace.blockworksolutions.com today, and you can buy Bitcoin miners that are plugged in at one of our owned or partnered data centers. You can be mining Bitcoin in several hours, right? It's just assigning the rig to you. And then Bitcoin rips, one, my yield goes up. It's awesome. I love it. I do not have the obligation, but I certainly have the option to sell that machine. So like, look at my M30S example, right? Like that was probably out of the money a few weeks ago. Now it's in the money. Now there's demand on that machine, $400. I want to go buy that. And then if we rip up to 40, K Bitcoin, which seems very not unlikely now in the velocity that we've had, now it's making, $50 a month. Like, it's going to be worth double, just logically. So I think in a nutshell, there's a lot of factors that go into Bitcoin mining. It is easy. It is definitely not simple. So it's important to choose, responsible, credible counterparty who's been there. But I think the option to have like turnkey liquidity is the game changer. And we saw, maybe a little before your time, Mitch, but like in the mining world in 2021, everybody's buying 4-month futures because there's no infrastructure and supply and machines are scarce. If you have the option to buy Bitcoin mining rigs and you're the one that is positioned incoming, you can charge like a 40% premium because you can just sell it right there. Right?
Yeah.
And if you get paid in Bitcoin for doing that, I'm just selling my Bitcoin making machine to get more Bitcoin, pulling my ROI forward. Right? So I think that's going to be a huge theme in this next, epoch and leading up to it. We're seeing transition of hardware, which means a lot of folks are selling legacy hardware, which provides opportunity for those who are, have a ton of conviction in Bitcoin, price action. And then it also is going to provide a lot of opportunity for folks to purchase next generation machines that are cheap right now that have an opportunity to appreciate drastically into the next, bull market where like you can't get your hand on mining equipment fast enough and you want to arbitrage that energy and create it into Bitcoin.
Yeah, so, I think. Yeah. I mean, you hit on some key points there, right? One, no other platform allows you to capitalize on the value of the ASIC itself. You just basically have to mine till it's dust and try to pay it off through that means. And two, with the infrastructure problem, with the excessive demand during bull markets, you want to buy turnkey. You want to buy now. You don't want to wait 4 months and Bitcoin price could go down. So the marketplace also allows for that. The most common concern I see with host mining is the trust aspect, right? How do I know that you're not going to rug pull? How do I know that my machine's hashing the right way? Can you talk a little bit about our facilities and how the transparency of the marketplace really alleviates a lot of those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, so, one, like Blockware's been around since 2017. We're, pioneers in enabling and bringing hash rate to the United States. We saw many kind of competitors pop up in 2021 when everything's super frothy and not a lot of folks made it, through 2022 or, have a lot of egg on their face, in that process. And I'm not gonna lie, it was not an easy process. Like all three of the major factors being Bitcoin price, difficulty, and energy prices raged against miners. Tough year to be a miner. Coming out of that right now, right? So I think, looking at longevity, looking at due diligence that's been done on different sites, how long things have been operating are key. But what's cool about the marketplace is, it's solving the three major challenges of Bitcoin mining, in my opinion, as you're looking at like mitigating risk. One, transparency. Like not all rigs are created equal. So every rig in the marketplace is plugged in. You can see the historic hash rate. I'm not buying something that might come dead on arrival. That happens, man. This is still an early industry. So that risk is eliminated and time is money and I'm putting the money down before I start yielding, right? So you want to minimize that gap, which brings me to my second point, which is, mitigating lead times, right? Like these are plugged in. This is a physical server that a human being needs to go plug in a data center. It is born somewhere in Asia, at initial time of birth, right? It gets on a train, or excuse me, it gets on a plane or a boat and arrives in our, you know, case to the United States. It goes through customs. It gets on a truck. It arrives at a data center. Human unloads it. It somehow, you know, there's a forklift involved at some point. Gets into a truck. It gets into a human's hands. It gets plugged in. Then it gets configured and assigned to somebody. Like, straight up, that takes time. Mm-hmm. So if you could then just eliminate all of the time that all of those, you know, literal factors that go into getting from zero to one and otherwise buying a Bitcoin mining rig and just buy something that can be online immediately, your lead time is mitigated. And one, you have significantly less uncertainty, but also you're able to start capitalizing on that, you know, capital expenditure immediately, right? Mm-hmm. So I think lead time's huge. And then the third we've already hit on is just like illiquidity being the challenge and the marketplace providing the option to get liquidity, right? It's, you know, Bitcoin mining kind of in a historical investment thesis capacity is really like a long lockup, you know, long capital lockup period, you know, dividend paying investment. And it's a good one, but having the option but not obligation to be more agile in that and to take advantage of what would otherwise just be paper gains and turn them into actual gains, you know, mm-hmm. on the back of significant difficulty decreases or price increase. Like, dude, look at when China banned mining. Like, okay, a drastic part of the network is going offline, like, instantaneously, right?
Yeah.
You're mining in that period, especially with a long time horizon where you don't, because in conjunction with this, the price of Bitcoin went down. But if I've got a long time horizon and I'm, you know, paying my bills with fiat and not, you know, my mined Bitcoin, I yeah. don't care what the price of Bitcoin is right now. I care what the price of Bitcoin is in 5 years, or, you know, insert whatever future time horizon you may have. So yeah. I don't care that, you know, Bitcoin takes a 40% no dive on price. I'm stoked that difficulty decreased by 40%.
Yeah, okay? Exactly.
And that's been a challenge, you know, this last couple of years, because difficulty has increased while price has decreased. But to our earlier point, I think it's a largely a byproduct of, you know, raging 2021 bull market, frothy capital markets, you know, those decisions to build out infrastructure and, you know, capture the incentives of mining as an opportunity. Those decisions were made in 2021, right?
Yeah.
There's less proportional, you know, money being put towards Bitcoin and, you know, mining, and decisions being made in November of 2022 or December or January of 2023, right? Yeah. Like, I'm also a realist, man. Difficulty is going in one direction, up, you know, yeah. like in perpetuity, but so is price. And difficulty helps secure the network. And that is good for the longevity of, you know, of Bitcoin as a secure, decentralized asset class. And price can outpace difficulty, you know, in spades. You know, you get to think about $1 million Bitcoin, Mitch, and how much, you know, let's even just say 300,000, let's say 10x Bitcoin. How much power and infrastructure do you need to have, you know, the hash price stay the same, to have 10x incremental, like 10 times more data centers, 10 times more energy, you know, mm-hmm. amount of energy being consumed? Like, dude, that's not easy. We've reached a
yeah,
scale.
Yeah, you need like 1,000 of Riot's Windstones for that. Something ridiculous. We should do the math on that. But it can't happen, right? It cannot do that.
I mean,
no, 10x.
It can't happen quick is the point.
Yeah.
Like, we can get to 10x, you know, in
couple
a
years.
You know, in a grandiose perspective, like reasonably quickly. I mean, I think like, you know, Middle East, I think, is going to be a huge player. I think that, you know, hash rate kind of like went domestic, you know, kind of North American domestic over the last cycle, you know, if you will, mm-hmm. largely on the back of China mining Bitcoin, you know, what's going on in Russia, a lot of just geopolitical uncertainty in different parts of the world. But I think we're going to start to get significantly more globally decentralized. I think the Middle East is a super logical hotbed for, you know, a lot of incremental Bitcoin mining investment, you know, cheap power, pretty much authoritarian, you know, decision-making bodies, yeah, like say go and shit starts moving pretty fast. And then theoretically, like infinite money, right? Like, yeah, that's a good recipe for mining a lot of Bitcoin. But even so, it is going to take a lot of, you just can only move so fast when you're doing all that. So yeah, incumbent miners win on the way up here.
Yeah, I 1000% agree. Where can the audience get in contact with you if they want to learn more about this and start mining with Blockware?
For sure. So you can hit me up at danny@blockwaresolutions.com is my email, or you can hit me up on Twitter, DannyCondon1989, you know, or hit up sales@blockwaresolutions.com if you want to learn more about this, or check out our website at blockwaresolutions.com and learn more about what we're all about.